Parshas Kisavo has a lot going on in the Parsha, and as I was going through in the earlier days in the week, I was trying to figure out what should we talk about. There are so many options, and I will tell you the truth. I started preparing different shiurim and then stopped in the middle. I was trying to figure out what would be the most interesting and relevant topic. Something that I was really going to talk about was, in this week's Parsha, we have the mitzvah of Bikurim. So you'll say the mitzvah of Bikurim is not relevant today because we don't have a Beis Hamikdash. But one thing that I was going to discuss was the Mishnah writes in Maseches Bikurim, what happens when you have a ger, what happens when you have a convert who brings Bikurim to the Beis HaMikdash, which obviously a ger is a full-fledged carrying member of the Jewish people, and he's supposed to bring Bikurim the same like anybody else. But what happens when he brings the Bikurim? The Mishnah says, Mevi ve'eno kore. There are a certain amount of psukim that are supposed to be said when one offers the Bikurim in the Beis HaMikdash. But it says that a ger is not able to say those psukim. Why? Because in the psukim it says, Asher nasata lanu Hashem. We talk about the thanksgiving that we have to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for giving us the land of Eretz Yisrael. Now a ger was not really given a portion in the land of Eretz Yisrael. So how can I say with a good conscience, Asher nasata lanu Hashem? So that is a discussion in the Mishnah in Maseches Bikurim. And from there, there is a major discussion in Shulchan Aruch and in all the Nosei Kelim. Well, if that's the case, then what does a ger do every time they come to the bracha of Shelo Asani Goy? What does a ger do every time they come to the Shemona Esrei and they're told, Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoseinu? Are they supposed to change the Nusach HaBracha? What exactly are they supposed to say? Do they leave it out? Or when they say in the morning, HaBocher Ba'am Yisrael Be'ahava? So that's a very important and interesting, rich debate, which actually came to the Tshuvas HaRambam. There was a personality in the days of the Rambam by the name of Ovadia HaGer, who actually sent a letter to the Rambam and asked him, what am I supposed to say when we have in the Siddur, HaBocher Ba'amo Yisrael Be'avo, that you chose us seemingly at Har Sinai, we were the ones who became chosen, but I was not there. And I'm the one who came along much later in history. So that is a very important question. Actually, this week, when I was with Rav Asher Weiss, right after we had the get-together, we went to somebody's office, I brought him to meet an individual there, and the person asked, he has a child who is in Shidduchim, and he asked, should my child automatically say no to somebody who is a ger or a gioris? I don't know if he has a boy or a girl. I don't know what he was referring to, but he wanted to know, should he say no? And Rav Asher Weiss looked at him quizzically and he said, why would you say no? Just because the person is a ger, why is that a reason to say no? Now, there may be other reasons to say no, like maybe there's a very complicated family dynamic between the individual and his or her family and his or her siblings or parents, or whatever. That's a separate issue. But that could be with a person who grew up in a religious family in a Jewish home, also has complicated relationships. So that's not a disqualifying factor in and of itself. So Rav Asher Weiss asked him, why would you say no? Where are you coming from? So he said, well, after all, you know, the ger comes from Zera Tameh. The ger comes from impure sources. His father is not a Jew, her father is not a Jew, and therefore, maybe that's something I should stay away from because it's not the yichus that I'm looking for. He didn't mean to say fancy yichus. He's just saying, maybe I don't want that kind of origin in my family. And Rav Asher Weiss said to him, can there be a greater mitzvah of ve'ahavtem es ager than to actually marry the ger and care for your spouse every day of your life going forward? Beyond that, he said, so you're going to set your child up to go out with somebody else, and you're assuming that that person has a clear line of yichus that brings them back all the way to Moshe Rabbeinu, to Aaron HaKohen, to whoever it is. He says, do you really believe that we have a clear yichus of whose parent married who, and whose grandparent married who, and which community they were from, and who's a Kohen and who's a Levi, and where everybody's origins are really from? Can you date yourself back to all the generations that came before us? He said, the cleanest yichus a person can have is a ger. Because we really know with certainty that that person is a Jew. Which was a fascinating perspective. And then he got into a whole interesting discussion about how much we have to respect the choices of a ger and how much we need to value and celebrate what it is that they've done and the commitment they've taken upon themselves. It was a very fascinating discussion, but it reminded me of this conversation that really stems from Mishnayis Bikurim. What happens when a ger confronts all of these issues? And that's what the Rambam tries to address in his response to Avadya HaGer. What do you do about the fact that a ger is going to be confronted with all these different brachos, and even if they are a card-carrying member of the Jewish people, and even if they integrate seamlessly, and even if everybody responds to them positively, v'ahavtem es ager, and we do what we're supposed to do, we're still going to have uncomfortable moments where the ger feels, hey, how can I say this bracha when it's really not referring to me, when it's really not a reflection of the life that I live? So, I was going to talk about that, and then I realized, well, It's not so relevant to everybody here because, after all, I don't know how many of you stem from a family of Gerim. If you do, great. If you don't, also great. So I'm not sure how relevant it is or how often you're going to be confronted with a situation where a Ger is going to ask you the question. So I didn't think that that was worthy of a discussion in our form. It's worthy of discussion anyway, but it's not something that I thought was worthy of an entire shir, even though there's so much to say about that topic. I then turn the pages a little bit further, and I realize it says, Arur makle aviv v'imo. And I said to myself, is there anybody in this class that really is confronted with this issue of hitting their parents? That's not something that I imagine most members of our shir would be busy doing. Most members of our class are probably not so involved in that. So Arur makle aviv v'imo, I would say, is probably irrelevant. Then I was reminded, nah, maybe it is relevant. Why? Because there's a big discussion. Anybody here planning on going into medicine? Okay, so what happens if one's parents, at some point along the line, you plan to be a doctor, a nurse?
PA.
A PA. I didn't give that option, I'm sorry. Yes, what do you plan to do?
Doctor.
A doctor? Okay, and you?
A doctor.
So you need to negotiate. I heard that Stern no longer gives the scholarships for medical school that they used to give. True, not true?
Yeah.
What? I don't know, you got to look into it. Don't, you know, don't fall into it later and then come up with a surprise. Somebody just called me a couple of weeks ago and asked to negotiate on their behalf. I said, I have no negotiating power. I'm not the one who gives out the money. But I think there used to be some kind of grant that somebody gave for women in Stern College to go to medical school, and the arrangement is no longer what it was once they sold Einstein. Look into that. Anyway, so if you plan to be a doctor or a nurse or a PA, so you're going to have parents at some point that are going to need a shot. You're going to have parents at some point that are going to need medical care. Or if you're going to be a dentist and you're going to have to pull a tooth, your parent is going to be much more comfortable going to you than they'll be going to somebody else, because they know that the person who's going to care for them best is their own child, provided that you actually know what you're doing. I actually found it humorous during COVID when some shuls were having like committees, shuls were having committees of doctors who were weighing in on what should the protocol be when it's COVID, and they were having like dentists on the committee and orthodontists on the committee and podiatrists on the committee. I'm thinking to myself, why is the podiatrist any more qualified than the accountant in town who knows nothing about this area of medicine? So it was actually humorous. So your parents will come to you if you are in that area of expertise. Your parents are obviously not going to ask you to pull a tooth if you happen to be a PA and know nothing about it. But what do you do when you have that situation? Are you allowed to pull your parents' tooth when you know that you are going to be drawing blood in doing so? Is that part of this prohibition of Arur makle aviv v'imo? That is a very fascinating and important discussion. Again, not what we're going to talk about today, but there is so much to discuss about that. I'm trying to bring out to you that as you go through every parsha, there is so much to talk about, and you probably don't even realize it. But I really wanted to discuss, and unfortunately I just didn't have enough time to formulate an entire mahalach, an entire position on this issue, is Zichuyat HaYotzrim, which means, anybody knows what that means? That means copyright laws, right? So what rights do I have? The pasuk in this week's parsha writes, Arur Masa Gevul Re'ehu. So what happens if I have somebody who has a business, and now I come in and I open the same business, and I'm now compromising his ability to make a parnasa? So there can be 1,000 variations of that scenario in many different kinds of ways. And in this complicated world, it becomes even more complicated because we have online businesses. So you can open an online business and you can be reaching out to customers all over the world, and you can then be encroaching on other people who had a business that was functioning and operating very well. So what are the laws that govern Arur Masug Gevul Re'ehu? What happens when I have a claim that somebody says, you're being Masa Gevul, you're taking away my customers? Do I have a right to open such a business? What are the copyright laws? How far do my rights actually go? Anyway, a lot to talk about in every parsha. And you'll notice as you get into it a little bit that sometimes, even in the parshios and Sefer Bereishis, when they seem to just be storytelling, there is so much beneath the surface of the text. And sometimes Rashi doesn't even bring it to our attention. If you ever looked at the Chumash Torah Tamimah, you know that the Torah Tamimah is a Chumash, is a commentary on Chumash, where he basically collected all of the relevant Gemaras that have to do with that week's Parsha. And as a result of doing that, you get a glimpse into how much is beneath the surface of the text and how much of Halacha comes from very seemingly mundane psukim that may be telling a story about Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron, and yet from the way that it's formulated, we learn a variety of halachas that are relevant to us every day. What we're going to talk about today is a different Mishnah Bikurim that has great ramifications in a number of different areas of halacha. So let us begin by learning the Mishnah together. I sent it out today so everyone can pull it up. We have a Mishnah in the third Perek in Bikurim, where we are told as follows. Hashor holech lifneim. So the story of Bikurim, which is in this week's Parsha, Parshas Kisavo, tells us about how the farmers used to have an obligation to take their first fruits and bring them up to Yerushalayim and offer them to the Kohen and the Beis HaMikdash. Now, the Mishnah says, Hashor holech lifneim. When they used to go to Yerushalayim, they would have a whole big procession that was going in front of them. There was a whole parade. And the farmers would travel with tremendous amount of fanfare. So they would have the oxen going in front of them, the karnav mitzupo zahav, and they used to paint the horns of the animal gold, the atara shel zayis berosho, and they would have a crown that was adorned on its head, hachalil maka lefneim, they had a marching band and a flute with drums in front of them, ad shemagiyim karav liyushalayim. Okay. Now they get to Yerushalayim, shochu lefneim, and they send messengers ahead to tell everybody in Yerushalayim, by the way, we're here. And the messengers all would come out, and they would all go out to be the representatives of everybody who lived in Yerushalayim, and they would come to greet these farmers who are coming to bring the Bikurim to the Beis HaMikdash. And then the Mishnah says a very, I guess would say, uncomfortable statement. It's not that I'm uncomfortable with it. The Talmud Yerushalmi is uncomfortable with it. It says, Lefi kavod hanichnasim hayu yotzim. We're going to get back to this later, hopefully, but commensurate to how prominent you were as a farmer or how important you were, that's what kind of greeting you got. That's what determined how many of the representatives from Yerushalayim actually came out to say hello to you. Okay, so that's what the Mishnah tells us. All the shopkeepers came out, the vendors came out, all the merchants came out, and they used to come and greet the farmers who had come all the way from wherever they lived to Yerushalayim. Okay. Now, the Gemara Maseches Kiddushin, as well as the Maseches Chulin, brings this Mishnah, and then asks the following question. What is so unique about this mitzvah Bikurim? Why is it that when I'm going out to Shacharis in the morning, and I'm very exhausted, why is it that all the members of my block don't come out into the street and make a whole procession for me and celebrate the fact that I'm going to do a mitzvah? Why is it that when I go outside to sit in the sukkah or to shake the lulav or to light the Hanukkah candles or anything else, that nobody's celebrating what I'm doing? What is so unique about Bikurim? That is the question of the Gemara. Answer number one that the Gemara gives is, Kedei shelo tehe machshilan li'asid lavo. What does that mean? Kedei shelo tehe machshilan li'asid lavo, Rashi there explains on the Gemara. What it means is, this is a very difficult mitzvah. This is a very great undertaking. How so? I'm a farmer. I'm not a wealthy person. I'm just trying to run my farm. I live all the way out in the Galil. Now I have to take 2 weeks off of work to travel on my horse and buggy all the way to Yerushalayim. I'm leaving my wife and children behind. I don't know what's going to be while I go to Yerushalayim. Who knows what's going to be with my field? First of all, there's nobody there to work the field because I'm in charge. Second of all, my family is not so safe. I don't know what's happening. It's a great undertaking. I take 2 weeks off of work to go travel to Yerushalayim. Then it's going to take me a week and a half or 2 weeks to get back. And it's a hard thing to do. And I lose parnasa the whole time that I'm out. So we need to do something to encourage people to want to do this again. This is a very difficult thing for a person to agree to do. And the way to encourage people is by having representatives from Yerushalayim come out and show them our appreciation, to show how much we value the commitment that they have to do the mitzvah Bikurim properly. And in doing so, we hope that we will encourage them in the future to want to do this again. How is this relevant lahalacha? You'll say, we don't have Bikurim today. We don't have a Beis HaMikdash. So what does this have to do with the lives that we live? The answer is, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein has a very important discussion in which he disagreed with some of the other great leaders of our generation, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and others got involved in this discussion as well. We know the Gemara tells us in Maseches Yuma, Minayin lepikuach nefesh shadocha es haShabbos. How do I know that saving a life is more important than observing Shabbos? And the Gemara gets into a whole lengthy discussion. The bottom line that the Gemara comes to is, the Torah says v'chai bahem, and we learn from the words v'chai bahem that we have an expectation that when Shabbos clashes with human life will take precedence to Shabbos. Okay, sounds good. That's good. Now, there's a very highly contentious issue. We are blessed to live in a generation where we have the services of Hatzalah. When you have the services of Hatzalah, they're there, they take care of you. But the shaila then became, is a member of Hatzalah able to travel back from the hospital on Shabbos after they've already done everything that needs to be done for the patient and handed them off to the hospital. Now, obviously, this is talking about a situation where you have more than enough Hatzalah members back in the community and you don't need this person to come back in order to potentially save other patients. So that's not the case we're talking about. If that were the case, of course the member of Hatzalah needs to come back because potentially they'll be needed to save another life. So that's not what we're referring to. We're referring to a case where you live in a community where there are plenty of medical professionals around, plenty of members of Hatzalah, and there's no concern that if the Hatzalah member is going to stay there for the rest of Shabbos, that it's going to cause any potential danger or harm to somebody's life. Would that member of Hatzalah be allowed to return from the hospital on Shabbos or not? Is a major debate, is a major dispute between Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and it really revolves around the Gemara Maseches Beitzah Daf Yud Beis, where the Gemara talks about Hitiru Sofa Mishum Tchilaso. Not important to get into the details, but it's a very complicated discussion and very relevant halacha lemaisa. Okay, so as I mentioned, this was a debate between Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Moshe Feinstein. Along comes Rav Herzog. Rav Herzog was the chief rabbi in Israel, and Rav Herzog weighed in on the issue. He has a tshuva sefer called Heichal Yitzchak, and he writes what in his opinion is an argument why the Hatzalah member should be allowed to come back on Shabbos. And he says, imagine the following scenario. I'm making it a little more dramatic than he describes it. But you have somebody who travels for business. He's away from his family all week. Comes home Friday afternoon, just landed in JFK. He comes into his house, quickly runs to take a shower. His kids haven't seen him. This one's pulling at him on this end. That one's pulling at him on the other end. This one wants to review their chumash in school. That one wants to review the Gemara. Everyone wants their father's attention. The wife wants her husband's attention also. Everything, it's wonderful. He says, okay, it's coming Shabbos. We're going to be okay. I'm going to sit down with everybody. We're going to have a beautiful Shabbos together, family time. I can't wait. Goes to shul. Comes back, says Kiddush. Right in the middle of Kiddush, he gets a Hatzalah call. Okay. The family understands he has to go on the call. Jumps up from the table, jumps in his car, runs to the call, ends up in the hospital with the patient, and now he's stuck here for the rest of Shabbos. Now I ask you, what's the likelihood that next Shabbos, when he gets a call in the middle of Kiddush, that he's going to run to take care of the patient? Very low. Why? Because look at the price he paid for going on the call. He ends up having a miserable Shabbos sitting in the lobby of a hospital for the rest of the time that Shabbos is around, all because he can't come back. So it's going to discourage him from wanting to do life-saving activities. And therefore, Rav Herzog said, we learn from this Mishnah that when you're confronted with a situation where it's a very difficult decision for a person to make to want to participate in this mitzvah, we as a community need to do everything in our power to help in any way we can to encourage you to want to do that again. And he said the only way to do so is by allowing that person to come back from the hospital on Shabbos and spend the rest of Shabbos with his family. And that's the argument that he has. Again, based on what we're told here from the farmers by Bikurim, where the Gemara says that it's most important to be able to encourage people to observe a mitzvah that is difficult for them to do. Let me give you another example. We know that the Sefer, the Navi Micha, we may not know so much from the Navi Micha, but something that's very famous from the Navi Micha in the sixth parak is, Higid lecha adam matov u'ma Hashem doresh mimcha. The Navi asks a very basic and obvious question. What does HaKadosh Baruch Hu want of all of us? So, if any of us would be asked that, we'd probably have a hard time articulating what exactly HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants of us. But the Navi tells us exactly what the answer is. Kiim avas mishpat ve'asos chesed ve'hatznei aleches im alokecha. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to live lives of justice, to be honest, upstanding people, to be avas chesed, to be involved in providing for others, and be involved in chesed in any way we can be. Ve'hatznei aleches im alokecha. Snias does not mean only the way that we dress. Hatznei aleches im alokecha means a mindset. It's a way of life. To living a life of tznius means in everything we do, in the way we speak, in the way we walk, in the way we interact with other people. I think about it now that I'm taking the train back and forth. You just get to observe the way other people behave. And I'm not saying Jews or non-Jews, it doesn't make a difference, but you look around the train and you see everybody sitting quietly on the train. Everybody just wants to relax and unwind from a difficult or complicated day, whatever it is that they had. And there's one person who's just talking so loudly on the phone, totally disregarding everyone, aside from the fact that it's a lack of avos abrios, it's a lack of understanding of other people's needs, it's a lack of tznius. It's a way of life, you know? There's a certain expectation of being a tzanua. You don't have to always stick out. You don't always have to make a scene. You can just be somebody who's understated once in a while. And that's really what the expectation is. So the Rama says, what happens when a person gives tzedakah? So the Rama tells us in Hilchos Tzedakah in Yerodea, you have it over here, Lo yispar adam mitzdakah shehu nosein. Do not flaunt, do not advertise and broadcast the money that you give to tzedakah. Ve'im mispar, and if you do choose to flaunt the charitable giving that you're involved with, Lo dai she'enu mekabel schar, not only do you lose the schar for what it is that you've done, Ela afilu ma'anishim oso aleha. You will be punished, says the Rama, for doing that. This is really sourced in the Gemara Maseches Ksubas, where the Gemara tells such an unfortunate story. The Gemara tells us that at the time of the Churban Beis Hamikdash, one of the major philanthropists in Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim was Nachdiman Ben Gurion. He was well known as a person who everybody used to come to his home. He took care of all of them. He used to give out money. He used to help all the aniyim. And the Gemara says that on one occasion, one of the Amoraim happened to notice that the daughter of Nachdiman Ben Gurion was picking through the garbage on the side by the garbage dump. And he turns to her and he says, one minute, are you the daughter of Nachdiman Ben Gurion? She says, yes. He says, well then why are you picking through the garbage? Your father's the multimillionaire. He's the one who's taking care of everyone. And she says, unfortunately, my father lost all of his money. And we don't have any food. And the best I can do is pick through the garbage to try to find something to eat. And he says, after all the tzedakah, after all the charity, after all the magnanimous giving that your father was involved with, this is what happens to his children? This is where your family is up to? It's a shame. And she responds, and she says, yes, my father was a very generous person, but everything he did was l'chvoda hu de'avid. All the tzedakah that he gave was not because he wanted to help people, but rather because he wanted to boost up his own ego. He wanted other people to respect him. He wanted other people to look up to him. And the only way for him to do that was to be the most powerful philanthropist in the country. And that is the only reason he did it. So that's what the Rama quotes here from that Gemara, that when a person only wants acknowledgement, when they only want recognition, someone has to be very careful when giving tzedakah in that kind of way. So much so, the Magen Avraham tells a story in the name of the Sefer Hasidim, that there was a community in Europe that they wanted to build a new shul. And generally, the way you build a shul is you go around to all the members of the community and you offer them, do you want to donate this? Do you want to participate in that? Or you put a tax on everybody because we need to build a shul. So everybody has to participate. There was one philanthropist in the community who said, I want to pay for the whole shul, but only if I'm the only one who's doing it. I don't want anyone participating together with me. And they asked him, why would you do that? Why would you spend all your money? And he said, well, I want my grandchildren to know who their grandfather was. And I'm going to put my name on the building, and everybody's going to know that I was the one who paid for this entire shul. I'm the one who took care of the community. And the Magen Avraham quotes from the Sefer Hasidim that somebody who wants a zecher ledavar, somebody who does it just because he wants his grandchildren to see his name plastered all over the building, lo yie lo zecher. That person will not be remembered. I got a shaila once from a South American country. Somebody wrote to me. It was amazing. Really an amazing story. I'm trying to remember, did they write to me? Or it was Rabbi Leibowitz sent it to me because someone wrote to him. It was a number of years ago, so maybe I'm mistaken on the details, but I definitely discussed the shaila with my father. Either it was sent directly to me or it was somebody else sent it to me. But this person was a member of the community. Everybody thought he was just a modest person. Nobody knew that he had a charitable foundation in the United States. He gave all of his tzedakah to a third party, and that third party used to give out checks to everybody. Nobody ever found out that he was the one who was giving it. Now, he said, every time there was a shul dinner, everybody gave $500. He gave like everybody else. But then on top of it, he had his foundation write a $5,000 check and send it in. Now, everybody was wondering, where's all this money coming from? But they couldn't figure it out. It was a foundation. There was no name attached to it. They had no way of identifying that he was the person who was behind it. That's the way it was going. And he said this is the way he was He was doing everything for years. He helped build the mikveh, he helped build the school, he helped build the shul, he helped everything, didn't take 1 ounce of credit. Matan beseser, which is the highest level of tzedakah. I shouldn't say the highest. I once said, doing this is the highest level of tzedakah, doing something. Somebody called me out and said, look in the Rambam, it's not the highest, it's the second highest. Okay, I don't mean the highest. Matan beseser is a very admirable thing to do. Okay, now that we cleared that up. So the Shiloh was as follows. He says, I have a daughter who's starting to date. Nobody in this community knows that I'm a charitable person. So is it right that my children are suffering in Shidduchim because I want to be a tzaddik? So I want to be righteous. I don't want anyone to know the tzedakah that I'm giving. It would definitely help my children if the word was out there, that people knew that I'm such a charitable individual. But then I lose this great mila, this great advantage of matan b'seser. So how much should I hold on to the matan b'seser and get the schar for that? And how much should I do on behalf of my children to help their opportunities at marrying somebody who really wants a girl from a family who's a charitable family? It was an amazing shayla. It's an amazing shayla. Fascinating. But this is obviously something that is very important and something that very rarely do we see actually playing out in person. So we know that given this psaka de Rama, I venture to say every one of us went to school or attends a shul or attends a university now that has names plastered all over the walls. Look right here. So how can that be? The Rama says that we're not allowed to take credit for the tzedakah that we give. And if we do take credit, we get punished for it. Look at the story of Nakdim and Ben-Gurion. So why do we do this? So in the end, the Rama justifies the minhag. The Rama defends it and he says in the name of the Rashba, he explains why it's permissible. And he says because if a person is going to do that, it will encourage others to want to give tzedakah as well. It will encourage other people. Look at charity campaigns today, right? When you have a charity campaign, that's the whole chachma behind it. They have one person gives, then the neighbor sees that they gave, so they want to be a part of it. Nobody wants to be left out of the action, so everybody gets involved, and that's how they raise money. And therefore, says the Rama, that is the way that we justify this practice that we found all over the world, that people take credit for the tzedakah that they give. Lahavdil Elef Alfei Havdelos. And do not compare these in any way. I'm just giving an example. We know, just to illustrate the point, we know that there are many Palestinian terrorists who are celebrated as a result of the horrific crimes that they're involved with. Because they killed Jews and because they gave up their lives, what they refer to as Al-Kiddush Hashem, their community celebrates them. They name soccer stadiums after them. They name tournaments after them. Why? Summer camps after them, because they want to encourage the children to do the same. When you celebrate someone, it is encouraging to other people to have the same kinds of behaviors as that person who they're celebrating. And therefore, Lahavdil, as I said, shouldn't be compared. But the Rama writes over here, this is why we have developed the minhag. We have developed the practice that, yes, in fact, we do take credit when somebody is involved in a mitzvah. And we do take credit when somebody is involved in a major tzedakah activity because we want to make sure that other people will be encouraged to do so as well. And the source of that is from this Mishnah in Maseches Bikurim, where we're told when you have a difficult thing to do, it requires encouragement on the part of the community to make sure that people are going to want to do it again. Sometimes you think to yourself, you know, this guy's a multimillionaire, this person has a very functioning, high-functioning business, you know, making a ton of money. What's the big deal to give tzedakah? It's always hard to part with our money. Parting with money is not easy, even if you have a lot of it. It's never an easy thing to do, and it's something that needs to be celebrated. In fact, I just gave a shiur last night about Shemitah's Ksafim. We have an opportunity in Chutz La'aretz. During the year of Shemitah, we are irrelevant. We don't live in Eretz Yisrael. The mitzvah of Shemitah is something that is only relevant to people who have farms in Eretz Yisrael, and we're not there. So is there any part of Shemitah that is relevant to us here in Chutz La'aretz? The answer is yes. There's a mitzvah of Shemitah's Ksafim, which is that at the end of Shemitah, any outstanding loan that we have has to be absolved. We are not allowed to go and collect it. Unless we use the workaround, which was instituted much later in history, called the Prizbal. If you want to know more about it, we can talk another time. But basically, the halacha is that after the year of Shemitah, we're supposed to absolve anyone who borrowed money from us is absolved of the loan that they may have taken from us. What is the reason for that? The Sefer Achinuch discusses, Rabbi Yonasan Ibeshitz talks about it, other Achronim talk about it as well. What is the reason why HaKadosh Baruch Hu expects that at the end of a Shemitah year, we're supposed to give away the money that we lent people? I'm rightfully deserving of that money. Sefer Achinuch basically explains that sometimes we have a very unhealthy possession of money not because we've done anything wrong, but we have an obsession with money. And every 7 years to remind ourselves, ki li kol ha'aretz, every 7 years to remind ourselves, yes, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who's going to give me a parnasa, if he so chooses to do. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who's going to make me have money, make me be successful, not allow me to be successful. All of that is in the hands of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it's healthy that every 7 years we have the opportunity to put ourselves in check on where our relationship with money is actually holding. That's what the mitzvah of Shemitas Kesafim is all about. And one should realize that when somebody is willing to get tzedakah, it's never an easy thing to do. It's not something that comes naturally to people. It's something that is a decision that they need to make, that they're willing to part with their money, money that is rightfully deserving to them because they worked hard for it. And that's something that we always need to keep in mind and celebrate, because it's a difficult thing for people to do. Beyond that, the Mishnah then tells us that everybody in Yerushalayim stands up for them. They go outside to celebrate the farmers who come to Yerushalayim. So the Gemara says, reason number one why they do that, as we mentioned, is in order to encourage the farmers to want to do this difficult mitzvah again in subsequent years. Number two, the Gemara says, because chaviva mitzvah b'shaita. Chaviva mitzvah b'shaita means that we should show respect. They are worthy and deserving of respect when they are observing and performing a mitzvah. You ever notice? I'm assuming people here have been to a levaya before. So you come to a levaya, and right before they start, somebody makes an announcement, all rise. You ever wonder, why are we standing up? I'll be honest, sometimes I go to a levaya, I really didn't have so much respect for the person when they were alive. Sometimes I go to a levaya because I'm expected to be there. Sometimes I go to a levaya because I'm friendly with their children. Not because I respected that person so much. So why do I stand up when they bring the aron into the room? What's that all about? Explains the Bar Tanura on Mishnayos Bikurim. The answer is, we're not standing in honor of the person who is deceased. We're standing up in honor of the Chevra Kadisha, who are helping out with the mitzvah of Gvuras HaMeis. We show honor to people who are involved heavily in a mitzvah. You ever go to a wedding? We stand up for the chasen and kala. Why do we stand up for the chasen and kala? Some people mistakenly think the reason is because chasen dom el melech. Since we know that a chasen is like a melech, so therefore you have to stand up for a king when he walks into the room. It's wrong. Why is it wrong? Anybody know why it's wrong? Chasen dom el melech means after he gets married, he's dom el melech. Right now when he's walking down the aisle, he's nothing. Rav Soloveitchik actually was very opposed to, after one gets engaged, to calling yourself a chasen or a kala. He used to say everyone should refer to themselves as a mishudach and a mishudechas, which is a strange way to say it. Why? Why don't you say chasen and kala? Because he said, right now your status is nothing. You got engaged, you're not halachically engaged, you're nothing. You are two good friends that went on dates, and now you like each other, you appreciate each other, and you have every intention of getting married. The problem with calling each other chasen and kala, he said, is people tend to feel that they can break the rules of yichud and halacha once they call themselves a chasen kala. Well, we're already like almost married, so therefore we're allowed to do X, Y, and Z, and don't think it's not going to be you. Rachmana litzlan, I've met people before who are wonderful yirei shamayim and who have made mistakes and who have slipped before in the time of engagement. It happens. It happens. That's where Rav Soloveitchik felt. Don't call yourself chasen and kala. Make an extra gather. Remind yourself, I'm not yet a chasen. I'm not yet a kala. We'll get there. So why do we stand up for the chasen and kala if he's not even a chasen yet? Actually, Rav Pam was once asked, if a chasen dom el melech, so the chasen went over to Rav Pam and he asked him, how long is that status going to last? How long can I consider myself a king? Strange question to ask. Rav Pam said, as long as you treat your wife like a queen, you can still be considered a king. You should have that expectation of all your husbands. As long as you treat your wife like a queen, you have a right to consider yourself a king for your whole life. So why do we stand up for a chasen and kala? The answer, says the Bar Tanura, has nothing to do with chasen dom el melech. The answer is because we want to show respect to somebody who's engaging in the mitzvah of kiddushin v'nisuin. Somebody who's about to observe this mitzvah is somebody that is worthy of being celebrated. And that is why we stand up. You ever notice by a bris milah? They call out, Kvater, and everybody stands up. What are you standing up about? What did the child ever do to deserve respect and honor? The answer is we're not standing up for the child, we're standing up for the Balei Bris, which are the people, the parents, the Kvater, the people who are about to perform the mitzvah of Bris Milah. We stand up in their honor to show our kavod for the mitzvah itself. We go a little bit further in the Mishnah, and you look back at number Aleph, and you see the Mishnah writes as follows. It says that when the farmers used to come to Yerushalayim, everybody used to come out and greet them. However, the Mishnah says, "Lefi kavod hanichnasim hayiyotzim." Based on how prominent, how important you were, that's the kind of reception that you got when you came to Yerushalayim. Now, the Yerushalmi asks a penetrating question: "V'chiyesh katan v'gadol b'Yisrael?" Do we believe that some members of the Jewish people are deserving of more honor than others? Do we believe that some are more prominent than others? What does that mean? Depending on how important you were is what kind of reception you got. Everybody should have had the same reception. You're coming to do a mitzvah in the Beis HaMikdash. You're traveling all the way. Everybody deserves honor for that. And it doesn't matter who you are or where you come from. So what exactly does this mean? Don't we know that all of them are beloved and admired in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? There is no hierarchy when we refer to connecting with the Ribbono Shel Olam in terms of mitzvahs. I'll give you an example. The Gemara says in Maseches Kiddushin. The Gemara says, Parnes, when you have a community leader, when you have somebody who is in a position of communal leadership. So the Gemara says, Asur lo sheyasa malacha bifnei shlosha. It's degrading, it's demeaning for that person to do work, to do some kind of menial labor in front of other people. Anybody reading the articles on King Charles? Anybody following what's going on there? You read last night what it said?
Not specifically.
Okay. So what I read last night, maybe it's a waste of my time, I shouldn't be reading this, but I read last night that all of a sudden his misharsin, all of his, whatever you call them, his gophers? I don't know, what's the right word for that? His henchmen, right? All of his people are talking about what it's like to take care of a king or to take care of a prince. Imagine waiting 73 years for your job. It's amazing. It's a lot of patience. So they were talking about what it's like to serve this individual. And they said, in the morning, they literally do everything. They shine his shoes. It says that they iron his shoelaces every morning before he puts them on. Okay? And beyond that, it says that they put the toothpaste on his toothbrush every morning. So when he walks into the bathroom, it's there. So I think that's taking it to an extreme. But the Gemara does say it would be a little bit of a bizayon. It would be a little bit, not embarrassing, but it would be out of place for somebody in a very prominent communal position to be lying on the floor underneath the hood of his car trying to be a mechanic and getting his hands all dirty. That wouldn't really make sense. It's not the right thing for you to be doing. Why? Because you represent the dignity, the honor of the whole community. And by doing that, you're really degrading the community. You're not just degrading yourself. That's what the Gemara says. However, says the Gemara, and this is Paskin and Shulchan Aruch and Choshen Mishpat, when it comes to doing a mitzvah, he shouldn't feel uncomfortable at all. So it says, even though he shouldn't be the car mechanic, and even though he shouldn't be doing things that look like they're not befitting of him, but yet the Gemara does say that when it comes to building his own sukkah, he should do it, even if it means he's going to get his hands dirty, and even if it means he's going to maybe do things that otherwise he wouldn't do, but it's for the sake of a mitzvah. When it comes to a mitzvah, all of us are equal. There is no hierarchy in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu when it comes to doing a mitzvah. And similarly, the Shari Tshuva writes in Aruch Chaim an interesting story. He says, I'm sorry, the Mishnah Berurah quotes a Chavos Yair. Chavos Yair was Rabbi Yair Bachrach in the 1600s, where he writes the following story. He says that there was a rabbi who also knew how to play beautiful music. He was a musician. And he was asked to come to a wedding not as the Masada Kedushin, but rather as the musician. Interesting. So the rabbi felt very uncomfortable. I've never been asked to go anywhere and play music. I've been asked to serve in my rabbinic role, not in my musician role. I find it so beautiful when Rabbi Willick, who actually knows how to play guitar, shows up with his guitar. You ever been there when he does that? So it's like, you know, shows a very different side of him, and it's very sweet, and it's very nice. In my eyes, it doesn't degrade him at all. In my eyes, I think it only elevates him. It shows that he has something else to offer us and to inspire us with his ability to sing and to play music. But this Shiloh was sent to the Chavos Yair. Should the rabbi, who is also a musician, agree to attend the wedding when all he's being asked to do is be the musician? And the Chavos Yair responded to him and he said, why wouldn't you? There's a mitzvah, l'smach, l'sameach chasan v'kala. To be m'sameach l'chasan v'kala is a very important mitzvah, a beautiful mitzvah to be involved with. Do you think you're above it? Do you think it's beneath you to do such a thing? Of course you should jump at the opportunity. And the Chavos Yair responds that whenever it comes to a mitzvah observance, to a mitzvah opportunity, nobody should ever look at themselves as something being beneath them. In fact, he brings a proof to it. He says, Moshe Rabbeinu himself was asked to do Hakamas HaMishkan every day for the Shivas Yimei HaMiluim. Moshe Rabbeinu was asked to take the Mishkan down, put it back up, take it down, put it back up. Ask the Gemara Maseches Menachos, there was nobody who was willing to help him? An entire Jewish people, millions of people around him. Everybody was camping around the same campsite. Everybody was watching. Moshe Rabbeinu was in the center. And every day, everybody woke up and watched the same thing happen. Nobody bothered to ask Moshe Rabbeinu, do you need some help? Maybe I can hold a screwdriver for you? Maybe I can hold that beam over there? No, Moshe Rabbeinu did it himself. Lo siyu echad hakohanim. Nobody was willing to help. Aaron HaKohen wasn't willing to help. Maybe you'll say everybody in the Jewish community just didn't get it. Aaron didn't know what was going on. Everybody knew what was going on. So how could it be that nobody bothered to offer Moshe Rabbeinu help? The answer is, of course they did. They were all very understanding, but Moshe Rabbeinu felt, this is not beneath me. This is my mitzvah. And I feel proud that I was given the opportunity to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu in this way. And I wouldn't give it up for anything. I want to keep on this opportunity, and I want to be able to do it by myself. So this really is something that we learn from this Mishnah as well, that when it comes to a mitzvah, we should never feel that there is something that is beneath us. There's a fascinating story in the Shari Tshuva in Hilchos Dalet Minim. Shari Tshuva writes that there was a community in Europe where there was a shortage of lulavim and asrogim one year. And there was one individual in the community who was very wealthy, who decided that he was going to go way out of his way, weeks before Sukkot, to try to procure for himself a set of dalet minim. So he had somebody import it from a foreign country, he brought it into his house, he was very excited, comes the first day of Sukkot, he shows up to shul, everybody's there, and the minute they're ready for halal, he whips out his lulav and esrog, everybody turns around, and there's a whole commotion, everybody's fighting, screaming, yelling. And he says to them, what's your problem? Why is everyone yelling at me? And they say, if you only were able to get one set of dalet minim, if all you were able to do was get one lulav and one esrog, you're not going to give it to the rabbi? You're going to keep it for yourself? And he turns to them and he says, if the rabbi really wanted a dalet minim, he could have worried about it himself. I should give him mine? And a big fight broke out in the shul. It turns out, after all the fighting, the rabbi turns around and he sees there's a commotion. He asks them, what's going on? Now, he just became in a very awkward position because the fight is actually about him. So he asked them what's happening. They told him the back and forth. And he says, he's right. It doesn't belong to me. We all have equal opportunity to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We all have equal obligation to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we all need to shake Dalet Minim. Why is my mitzvah more important than his mitzvah? Why should I get the Dalet Minim before he gets it? And that again proves this point. Is there anyone in the Jewish community when observing a mitzvah that is not considered worthy? Is there anybody that is considered more important than somebody else when they are serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu? All of us are the same. We all have equal opportunity to connect with Him and to be inspired by doing so. We then go a little bit further. The Mishnah tells us in Bikurim another very interesting and very relevant halacha. Mishnah says that along with the mitzvah of bringing the fruits to the Beis HaMikdash, there was also an obligation for the farmer to recite a number of psukim when he got there. So in doing so, the Mishnah says, the way it used to be was, a farmer would show up to the Beis HaMikdash. If he knew how to read the psukim, if he was literate, he would open up a siddur, open up a chumash, and he would say the psukim. What if he didn't know? What if he was totally uneducated? So the Gemara says, the Kohen used to say word for word, and tell him what to say. It got to a point where the Mishnah says it was humiliating. I would come to the Beis HaMikdash, I would stand online with my Bikurim, I would see the first 10 people before me knew how to say the Psukim, rattled it off, looked inside the Siddur, figured it out. And me, I have to wait there. Baruch, oh, Baruch, Ata, Ata. I have to repeat every word after the Kohen. It's embarrassing. It came to a point where a farmer says, I need to go travel 2 weeks to the Beis HaMikdash to go humiliate myself. Nimnu ma'am milahavi. The Gemara says, farmers, stop coming. Who wants that? It's a bizayim. So they decided we have to change the system. From then on, everybody became uniform. Everybody used to go through the same system. And that was, the Kohen said one word, and you repeat it after. Kohen said another, you repeat after. That's the way it went back and forth. Okay. So far, so good. And the same goes nowadays when we go to a wedding. Who says the brachas under the chuppah? Who's supposed to say the bracha under the chuppah? I always turn to the chassam when I'm misad a kedushin, and he turns to me and he says, "Harei at mekudeshes li." I'm like, no, you're not marrying me. Turn to the kala, turn to the bride and say, "Harei at mekudeshes." You're marrying her. Don't look at the rabbi. So it became standard practice that the rabbi, the misad a kedushin, makes the bracha under the chuppah. Why? It's not, he's not getting married. He's doing it on behalf of the chassam and the kala. Because maybe there's going to be a situation where you're going to have someone who's going to get married and won't know how to say the bracha on their own, and it's going to be very embarrassing that they're going to have to repeat after the rabbi. So we made one uniform standard practice that everybody has to do the same. We're going to have a representative say it on your behalf. This way, you will never be embarrassed. And this is a very well-known concept in different areas of halacha as well. So the Gemara says something very interesting. We may find it surprising. The Gemara says in Maseches Tainis, one of the happiest days of the year was Yom Kippur. Interesting. Why is that? I would have said the reason is because it's the day of tshuva. It's the day that HaKadosh Baruch Hu accepts our tshuva. But the Gemara adds on to that, that one of the reasons why Yom Kippur was so exciting is because on Yom Kippur, all the women in the community used to go out into the fields. All the young men used to come out of shul. And they would make shidduchim on Yom Kippur. It's a great time to make a shidduch. Not the day I would have chosen to do that. But the Gemara says that was the practice. Everybody used to go out, and the girls would try to ingratiate themselves to the young men, and they would try to make shidduchim. Everything was great. Then the Gemara said they ran into a problem. What's the problem? The fancier girls used to come dressed up, makeup, and with jewelry, and with the fancy clothing and everything, and they were the first ones that were noticed. And the simpletons in town weren't able to do that. And they were the last ones to be remembered. So the Gemara says it wasn't fair. It was a system that didn't work. There were girls who weren't getting the boys that they wanted to marry just because they couldn't look the same way that other ones did. So the Gemara says we have to change the system. What's the system? From that time on, the Gemara says nobody was allowed to wear their own fancy dresses. Everybody had to borrow from somebody else. You weren't allowed to go outside with your own clothing. You had to borrow from someone else. This way, we keep it uniform. We keep it level playing field. Everyone has equal opportunity. Okay. And this is something that the Gemara says we try as much as we can in so many different ways. Another example the Gemara gives is that we're told in Maseches Moed Katan. It sounds strange to us, but this is the reality. The Gemara says, when somebody used to be sitting Shiva, so the community members used to come over and bring food, same way we do it today. Right? Shiva houses sometimes have different flavors, different styles, but every Shiva house has food, tons of food. Conservative, Reform, Orthodox, for some reason, that minhag went across the board. Everybody has food in the shiva house. So the Gemara says, what did they actually used to drink in the days of the Gemara when somebody was sitting shiva? The Gemara says, every day of shiva, they would come to the house of the Avil and bring 10 cups of wine. Wine? When you're sitting shiva? The Gemara says, yes. In fact, the Gemara tells us, lo ivri yayin, Ela l'nachem avelim. The whole reason why wine was actually created was to be able to alleviate the pain of an avel. Because sometimes you have a person who feels extremely distressed, very disappointed, very agitated over a loss that they're suffering. And the way to alleviate that pain is give them something to drink. And the Gemara says that's what they used to do. However, the Gemara says it depends what kind of member of society you were. And that's how we determined which kind of offerings to bring to your house. So if you were from a very wealthy family, your friends used to come with big gold and silver cups, and they used to bring you these fancy wines, and it was a great time. What if I was from a simple family? The Gemara says, well, then you can't get the plastic cups with the Kedem grape juice. That's what you got when you were sitting Shiva. The Gemara says it came to a point, nobody wanted to sit Shiva anymore. Everybody in the community is going to find out how much money I have based on what kind of wine they bring to my house. Based on the kind of cups that they're served in, it was embarrassing, it was humiliating. So the Gemara says we made one uniform standard. From now on, everybody gets the same. The same plastic cups with the same Kedem grape juice. Doesn't matter how much money you have, that's what we bring to everybody because we want to make sure that nobody's going to ever be embarrassed. Now, that being said, we then turn to the Mishnah Bikurim where we're told the following. The Mishnah tells us they used to have farmers traveling to Yerushalayim and offering their Bikurim. Writes the Mishnah, Ha'ashirim. The wealthy, successful farmers used to come to the Beis HaMikdash with big gold and silver baskets and they had the fruits coming out of them, and it was a whole scene when they showed up. And what about the simple farmer who didn't have any money? He couldn't afford that. So he shows up in the Beis HaMikdash with what? With sal shel netzarim. You know what that means? A wicker basket. That was the best he could do. He puts all his fruits in a wicker basket, travels to Yerushalayim, gives it to the Kohen. Isn't that embarrassing? Why don't we make one uniform standard that everybody has to use wicker baskets? And we shouldn't allow one person to outdo the other. Question number one. Question number two is, the Mishnah then says that when the poor farmer used to offer his bikurim with a wicker basket, the Kohen took not only the fruits, but the Kohen used to keep the basket as well. When the rich farmer came with his big gold and silver basket, the Kohen used to remove the fruits from the basket and give him back the basket. So the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. How is that fair? The one basket that I have, my wicker basket, you're going to take it away from me? Right? You feel bad for the farmer. So what's happening? How come this is the one place where we don't find a uniform standard? We're so careful to be sensitive to people's feelings. We don't want anyone to feel left out. We don't want anyone to feel slighted. Nobody should feel humiliated, embarrassed. That's why we do it by the wedding. The Masada Kedushin says the bracha. That's why we do this. That's why by the Avelim. Everything is uniform. Suddenly it comes to Bikurim and we don't care about someone's feelings. Why not? So I want to learn together with you a comment of the Malbim. This Malbim is so beautiful. Let's read his words. The Malbim lived in the 1800s, passed away in 1879 in Romania, in Prussia. So let's see what he writes. In our Parsha, Parshas Kisavo, says the Malbim, the answer to this question is just such magnificent interpretation that he gives. Derech ha'ani sha'ose ba'atzmo ha'tenet. The poor farmer doesn't go to the Judaica store and buy a gold or silver basket. He can't afford it. So what does he do? Ose ba'atzmo ha'tenet. Imagine, he comes home from work, and he's exhausted working in the field. Have any of you met any farmers over this year during Shemitah? Right? So you hear from them what it's like. Forgetting about Shemitah, they describe what a work day is like during the rest of the 6 years. It's very hard work. It's menial labor. It's very difficult. So the farmer comes home at night, and all he wants to do is go to sleep. He's so exhausted. But he says, you know, in 2 weeks from now, I'm going to have to travel to Yerushalayim with the Bikurim. I'll tell you the truth. I can't afford to buy a basket, but I'm left with no other option. How am I going to get the fruits there? I guess the only option is that I have to weave my own basket. And every night as he's falling asleep on the couch and drooling over himself, he's sitting there trying to create a basket with his own two hands, as best as he can possibly do. Writes the Malbim, Mistama l'shem habikurim asa tenachadash kedei shiyeh b'tahara. He invests of his time and his effort and his energy to make this basket by himself. Uba'avur shetarachba, says the Malbim, because he put in and infused his own effort into it. Zacha sheyeh tafel l'bikurim v'shiyeh l'kohen. Writes the Malbim, you're going to be embarrassed when you show up to the Beis HaMikdash with a wicker basket? When the person in front of you has a big gold basket with all of his fruits in it? It's worthless! You think HaKadosh Baruch Hu cares about his gold and silver? It means nothing. You know what? The Kohen turns to him and says, take your basket home, we don't need it. You went to the Judaica store yesterday to buy yourself a basket, it's worth nothing to me. You know what's worth something? I'll show you. A farmer who went and invested of his time and his effort and took away from his ability to go to sleep because he knew that he has this mitzvah coming up and he has to do whatever he can to make it presentable. Writes the Malbim, the Kohen celebrates that farmer and says, not only do we value your hard work, I want to keep this basket because it's so meaningful to me. Because it's worth the world to me. That's what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants of all of us. And that, he says, is what we always need to think about and a perspective we should always have whenever we observe mitzvos. It's the value and the effort that we put into it that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants so much in our mitzvos. He doesn't care how much money we spend. He cares how much we invest of ourselves in the participation of a mitzvah. I don't know if anyone here remembers, before we used to have the pop-off tops of Hanukkah candles. I happen to be a huge mefunuk. I hate being dirty. I hate if my hands ever have anything on them. It's just maybe it's a big chisaron in me. I like being clean. I hated putting my fingers into the oil and then You know, the wick used to drown in the thing. You had to get it out. I don't have a tweezers, you know. I don't have a makeup set. So I used to actually have to stick my fingers and take it out. It was disgusting. But the experience of Hanukkah was so different. When every night you had to clean that out, put in the new oil, and make sure it was filled the right way, and make sure you set it up. It felt so different than the experience that we have today. You just pop the thing off 2 minutes before you light. You know, you're ready to go. Everything out. Tonight we'll light here. Tomorrow we'll be over there. Put them in the box. It's just not the same. It's just not the same experience. Rachmana liba baya. Kadosh Baruch Hu wants us. He's not interested in our money. It's not valuable to him. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants our involvement. He wants to see that we're interested in exerting our own effort to observe a particular mitzvah that we are privileged to do. Do you know? I live in the Five Towns. I see you're wearing a Gourmet Glot sweatshirt. So, do you know that every year in Gourmet Glot, before Pesach, they sell ready-made, pre-packaged 10 pieces of bread to put out for Bedikas Chametz? Do you know that? I don't know if you own Gourmet Glot, but this is insane. It's beautiful. I'm not blaming Gourmet Glot. I don't think they make it. I think all the supermarkets sell it. But it's crazy. You can't even put 10 pieces of bread into a piece of foil before Pesach? I understand you don't want to cut up the vegetables. All right, it's too hard for you. You don't want to cut up the mango and the melon. So you get the pre-made, pre-checked, pre-made, everything. You can't put 10 pieces of bread into a piece of foil and put it out in your house? Actually amazing. It reminds me, I'm sorry that I'm digressing with stories, but it reminds me, there was once a woman who called me. She listened to a shiur that I gave before Pesach, and I said that if you go away on Pesach, you have to do Bedikas Chametz, right? If you're going to a hotel on Pesach itself, you have to do a Bedika when you get there. Why am I getting blank stares? Yes, you need to do a Bedika if you're going away on Chol HaMoed Pesach to a place where there was no Bedika before Yantif. That was done. Fine. So this woman calls me on Pesach, and she says, did I hear right? Did you say you should do a bedika? I said, yes, you have to do a bedika because you're going away with your children to a hotel on Pesach. Nobody was there the first days. We assumed it wasn't checked. You have to check it. Fine. She says, okay, no problem. She texts me, just went into the cabinet, took out 10 pieces of bread, wrapped them up to take along with us to do a bedika. I'm like, no! Like, no, that's really like Isser Daraisa on Pesach. That's not what I meant. So it just reminded me of that story. But nothing to do with what we're saying. But this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants of us. Rachmana liba baya. I remember there was a family in the Five Towns. They have an absolutely magnificent, beautiful home with art all over the place and antiques and things hanging up. Like everywhere you look, it's just like a whole scene, a whole story, a whole painting, picture, everything behind everything is like so significant. I remember going into the living room once and I saw, you ever seen fake flowers? Right, so some of them look like pretty presentable. These were the fakest looking fake flowers you've ever seen. And I'm looking like, what is that? It's so strange. Why is that in the middle of their living room for like everybody to celebrate? What is that? So I finally got myself to a point where I'm like, okay, I'm just going to ask them, what is this? So I said, what is it? So they said, for over 20 years, we had a housekeeper in the house who raised our children, who took care of everything for us, who came on vacation with us. When we went to Eretz Yisrael for Sukkot, she came with us. She was everywhere. She was part of our lives. Our children are all older now. Everyone's out of the house. We have nothing for her to do. We travel a lot. We're never home. So we had to let her go. We had no choice. We weren't going to continue to pay her to do nothing. So we sent her to a friend of ours. We got her a good job. She's taking care of their children now. But we had a 20-year relationship with this woman who did everything for us. And she says, the last day that the woman came to work, she walked out of the car, came up to the door with this fake flowers in her hands and said, you should know I saved up money the last couple of weeks to get you a gift because I knew this would be my last day here. They said this is the most valuable gift we've ever gotten. Because when you see what a person invests in the gift that they give you, it's valuable. You can spend all the money in the world. It's not worth anything if you know the person doesn't care on the other end. Money is not what gives value to our lives. What gives value to our lives is the amount that we're willing to exert the energy and the effort in the relationship that we're trying to build. This goes not only with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it goes with every relationship in our lives. How often do I see in our community, and not ours particularly, in all communities, where you see there are couples who will throw money at each other. I'm going to buy you a gift for Yontif. You buy this, buy that. But they don't care for each other. It doesn't help that you're buying a gift for Yontif. Your spouse does not want a new set of earrings. You know what they want? You. I always tell this to guys who are having issues in our community. I say, your spouse is not interested. The earrings are very nice. The necklace is great. Why don't you give her a night out just with you? Put your phone away. Leave it in the car. Don't look at your text. Don't look at anything. Give your wife one night of undivided attention. Trust me, that's worth more to her than all the jewelry that you're going to buy her before Yontif. You know, there's a discussion when we talk about Havdalah. So at the end of Shabbos, we know every week we make Havdalah. And Havdalah is comprised of a number of different components. So we have Bori Pri HaGafen, Bori Minim Samim, Bori Mari HaEsh, Hamavdim HaKodesh L'chol. You ever notice that after Yomtiv, we don't smell the Besamim? So why do we smell the Besamim after Shabbos? What is that all about? So the reason why is because the assumption is that we have a Neshama Yisera on Shabbos. After Shabbos is over, the Neshama Yisera leaves us, and we feel depressed about that, and we need to elevate, lift our spirits. So we smell the Besamim to make ourselves feel better over the loss of the Neshama Yisera. Beautiful idea, great idea, that's why we smell Besamim. What about Matzah Yantif? Why don't we smell Besamim Matzah Yantif? So some Rishonim say, well, we don't have that experience on Yantif. We don't have a Neshama Yisera on Yantif. It's only exclusively on Shabbos. And as a result, we don't lose it after Yantif is over because we never had it. So there's nothing to smell Besamim about. Other Rishonim say that is impossible. Do you believe that Shabbos has a Neshama Yisera and Yantif doesn't? In fact, the Stechemet writes that this is why on Shabbos and Yantiv we say Nishmas Kol Chai. It's to highlight, to celebrate the Neshama Yisera that we're given. And we say that both on Shabbos and on Yantiv, which seems to indicate that we have a Neshama Yisera both on Shabbos and on Yantiv. Well, if that's the case, why do we not smell Besamim in Havdalah on Matzah Yantiv? And the answer that is quoted in the Ramban doesn't explain it in full. The Shemi Shmuel fleshes it out a little bit more. But the answer he gives is as follows. While it's true that we have a Neshama Yisera on Yomtif just like we do on Shabbos, the nature of that Neshama Yisera is very different. You ever notice that on Shabbos we end off the bracha in Shmona Esrei? Mekadesh HaShabbos. Very simple and straightforward. We thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for being the one who brings sanctity into the day of Shabbos. How do we end off the bracha on Yomtif? Mekadesh Yisrael VeHazmanim. Why are we throwing in the Jewish people there? Mekadesh Yisrael VeHazmanim. What does the Jewish people have to do with Yontif? I mean, obviously we have a lot to do with Yontif. We celebrate Yontif, but we have a lot to do with Shabbos also. So why don't we say Mekadesh Yisrael VeHashabbos, just like we say Mekadesh Yisrael VeHazmanim? The answer is because the Gemara explains, Mekadesh HaShabbos is the Kedusha, the sanctity of Shabbos, comes directly from the infusion that HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts into Shabbos. Whether you like it or not, whether you prepare for Shabbos or not, Shabbos has a Kedusha that comes every seventh day of the week. Because it comes so easily, easy come, easy go. When Shabbos is over, that Neshama Yisera leaves us, and it's over. We did nothing to prepare or to deserve that Neshama Yisera. It's automatic. Yomtif, the Gemara says, the only way that Yomtif could be experienced is if we partner with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the process. We have to be Mekadosh L'Chodesh. We have to declare when it's Rosh Chodesh. As a result of that, we declare when it's Yomtif. And it's only because HaKadosh Baruch Hu infused Yisrael, it's only because he infused us with the Kedusha that in turn, we could be Mekadesh L'Zmanim. That's what we mean when we say Mekadesh Yisrael VeHazmanim. Mekadesh Yisrael VeYom HaZikaron. Mekadesh Yisrael VeYom HaKippurim. That's what we're going to say on Yom Tov. The point that we're trying to highlight is the only reason why we have the ability to be Mekadesh and experience Yom Tov is because you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, gave me a sanctity, gave me a Kedusha, and I'm infusing that into the day. Well, writes the Ramban, because we invested in the sanctity of Yom Tov coming into our lives, therefore, as a result of that, when Yom Tov is over, we don't lose that Neshama Yisera, because we created it. Something that we needed to work hard to create is something that will not be lost when the experience is over. And says the Ramban, that is why we don't smell Besamim after Yom Tov, because there is no loss of Neshama Yisera. Neshama Yisera is created by Yom Tov, by us, but it's something that is never lost. I'll just close off. I know we're over time. But let me just end with a very important comment that has to do with Rosh Hashanah. I don't know if we're going to have a chance to stick it into any other shir, but we'll stick it in here. Tikav v'shofar gadol l'cheruseinu. It's one of the psukim that we highlight in our Shemona Esrei, in Musaf and Rosh Hashanah. It's something we daven for every day. You ever wonder? What is the implication when we say, Tikav v'shofar gadol l'cheruseinu? If there's a shofar gadol, it means there must also be a shofar katan. What's the shofar gadol? What's the shofar katan? What are we talking about? What is that? It's not my question. Tikav v'shofar gadol is really borrowed from a pasuk in the Navi Yeshaya. And there the Medrash asks, what is the shofar gadol? What is the shofar katan? And the Medrash says, shofar gadol is the ayil shel Avraham Avinu. It's the shofar that was taken from the ram that Avraham Avinu found by the Akedah. What is the shofar katan? Writes the Medrash, HaKadosh Baruch Hu blew a shofar at Maimed Har Sinai. V'kol shofar chazak miyod. It says there was a blaring sound of a shofar at the time of Har Sinai. That is the shofar katan. It's backwards. The shofar that HaKadosh Baruch Hu blew when He accepted us as a nation is the shofar katan. And the shofar gadol is that of Avraham Avinu, the little ram over there that he found by the Akedah? And the answer is yes. The shofar gadol, what will bring geula to all of us, is our investment, what we bring to the table, what our relationship means to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the shofar gadol. That's what brings geula. What's a shofar katan? Yes, HaKadosh Baruch Hu on one occasion infused us with Kedusha. He came to Har Sinai, He chose us as a nation, Asher Bachar Banu Mikol HaAmim, V'nasal Nanu Es Tarasa, but that is not the most prominent and important shofar in our lives. In fact, there are two very important mountains in Jewish history. They are Har Sinai and Har HaMoriah. Har Sinai is very different than Har HaMoriah. Har Sinai, if one was to locate where Har Sinai actually is, it has no significance whatsoever. There is no halacha that governs the behavior or the conduct that one is supposed to have on Har Sinai. And yet we know when it comes to Har HaMoriah, even though there's no Beis HaMikdash today, we paskin like the Rambam, Kitcha Liyasid Lavo, you have to be very careful, you have to go to the mikvah, Tami is not allowed to go there, there's perhaps a Chiv Kares if you go to certain places. Why is that? What's the difference between Har Sinai and Har HaMoriah? The answer is, Har Sinai was something that HaKadosh Baruch Hu came, revealed Himself on the mountain. The minute Kabbalah Satorah was over, He left. Easy come, easy go. Kedusha is not retained in that way. What infused Har HaMoriah with Kedusha? Thousands of years of Jews investing of themselves to make that place a Makom Kadosh. It started with Avraham Avinu so many generations ago, who infused it with a Kedusha, with the amount that he was willing to sacrifice of himself and his child and his whole religion, all for his love of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And from that time and on, Jews have been doing the very same. And that is why that Kedusha is never batel. It doesn't matter how many millennia later it is, how many generations later it is, kitcha liyasid lavo, because that is something that is everlasting. That is exactly what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants of all of us. Rachmana liba boy. The Ribbono Shel Olam wants to see our investment in this relationship. He wants to see how much we care. He wants to see how much we're willing to do. What are we willing to give? What are we willing to put into a relationship with Him? That is what ultimately has significance. And that is why when it comes to the mitzvah of Bikurim, the Mishnah tells us that when you had the wealthy farmer who spent all that money, who bought the gold and silver basket, it's worth nothing to the Kohen. You know what? He turns around, takes the fruits out, sends it back with the farmer to his home. When we talk about a farmer who works hard, who invests of himself, who's willing to put himself on the line, who's willing to think about how much HaKadosh Baruch Hu actually means to him, that's more valuable than anything in the world. And it's an opportunity to think about it as we contemplate some of the valuable halachos and lessons that we can learn from a mitzvah that is not so applicable today because we don't have the Beis HaMikdash. It's an opportunity for us to think about how much we invest in our love of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. How much do we put into the relationship and how much it is appreciated by the Ribbono Shel Olam Himself. So Amir Tz Hashem.